This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about mental health nursing with John Barry Waldron. He's a mental health nurse, also behind the On The Ward podcast, which shines a light on real stories of people in a low secure mental health unit in terms of their experience, what's led up to them being there, and their journey towards recovery. He works incredibly hard to try and demystify and destigmatize the experience of being on a secure mental health facility. And this episode is one that's particularly close to our heart because our producer, Pete, also works in a similar environment when not on the podcast.
Multi-talented is Pete.
Absolutely. Keeps very busy. Yeah. We're all a bit like that. So first off, we've got a definition for mental health nursing from Wikipedia. Psychiatric nursing or mental health nursing is the appointed position of a nurse that specialises in mental health and cares for people of all ages experiencing mental illness or distress. So I thought that was a good broad one to start off with. We've also got a few key facts from healthcareers.nhs.uk. There are an estimated 35,000 mental health nurses in today's NHS workforce. However, more than 1 in 10 mental health posts are vacant. So that's mental health posts broader than just nursing.
Yeah.
But I thought that was a really interesting stat in contrast. That one's from the Department of Health and Social Care.
I know. I mean, when I read it, the first time I read it, I just thought, wow. Wow. Again, even the fact that there's this whole no jobs. But then you hear about, you know, jobs like that where we really need people and they're just left vacant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's very much a reflection of how challenging working in this kind of environment, this kind of role can be. It can be difficult to recruit people into it, or a lot of people go into nursing and they may be shy of going into mental health nursing particularly. I know in part that can often be due to the stigma that we're working so hard against, but also the challenges of that role and the stretch on resources mean that a lot of people leave it. So also from the Department of Health and Social Care, they reported that a total of 23,686 mental health staff left the NHS between June 2017 and the end of May 2018.
Wow.
That equates to about 2,000 a month. So when you compare that to the size of the workforce we mentioned earlier, that gives you an idea of the turnover.
Yeah.
That whilst the number of people in this profession is actually increasing, it's not as increasing as far as the demand is.
Absolutely.
And there's still a lot of vacancies there.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is because there's a lot of research. And when I was reading, people are leaving this environment. It's difficult, yeah. But what's frustrating for people like mental health nurses and practitioners in mental health is that they can't help as much as they want to because of the lack of resource. Our guest Stephen Tuck mentions it, the fact that actually I do more because I'm connected to my patients. I'm in the job for a reason, but the more I do, it's because there's not enough resource to support the people that they care about, which is why they went in it in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. That it can, at times when resources are stretched that much, it can distract from what the actual job is.
Yeah.
I certainly found that working in the police, that there were times when I didn't feel I was helping people because I was so caught up, I guess, in all the people we weren't able to help because we didn't have enough officers.
Yeah.
On the plus side, the number of officers are increasing in the same way the number of mental health nurses are increasing, but there's still that huge deficit. It's not filled the void yet.
No, it hasn't.
And it's not just that it's hard technically, it's so all-encompassing. You know, there's a physical side to it. There's the mental strain. There's the weight of these decisions affecting people's health so entirely. And particularly why I was keen to do an episode like this is the insight John Barry gives into this kind of working environment really opens up how vital workforces like his are. Because if you're in a secure mental health unit, Usually the only people you see are the staff and the patients, and so how they conduct themselves, what level of support they're able to give, shapes your entire recovery.
Absolutely.
You know, that whilst, particularly if you're sectioned, that's your whole world until you're taken off section.
Yeah, and as you know, I've got family members who have been sectioned recently, and, you know, it's really easy for family members to point the finger at the staff who are working with them. Why haven't you given them this? Why aren't you doing this? You should be doing that. You shouldn't be doing that. Because everyone just sees their own family member that needs that help for recovery, not the million other patients and the stress that these staff are under.
Yeah, so they will often get visits from family members, but it's usually after a 2 or 3 month sort of assessment period whether they're going to be able to handle that sort of thing. Mm. And sometimes you do get issues. Like recently, the patients on the ward have had mobile phones, which is quite a new thing for a medium secure ward.
Oh.
They're not like smartphones or anything, but they're just like your standard sort of like burner type phones. Or
like
whatever.
A Nokia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like a 3310 or whatever.
That brings me back.
Yeah, showing your age there,
Pete. Yeah, exactly. But sometimes you'll actually get issues where the patient is in their room texting their family paranoid thoughts about the staff doing things to them, about us persecuting them. The family members will phone up the ward and be like having a go at us for stuff that's just complete paranoid delusions that the patient is having in their room. But the family members obviously really concerned for whatever it is in their mind. But they don't know how to take it because they're always going to take those sort of things seriously, even if they have insight into the illness.
And also they don't probably understand how things are actually run. You know, this comes into what John Barry tries to do of educate people on what these wards are really like.
Mm-hmm.
That if you don't know the ins and outs, you might believe all sorts of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. Most parents are going to believe their son or daughter, even if they know their son or daughter's got issues and they know they're in the best place for them.
Wow, I wouldn't have even thought of that in terms of the phones. I mean, I'm glad, I guess, it's a Nokia and not some of the smartphones that could...
See, that's the main
all
thing.
Sorts
it's just
more could happen.
Internet access generally is the issue. Mm. Whether they can chase up people that have been victims of their crimes in the past and stuff like that.
If they're obviously criminals, the listeners that we're talking about.
Yeah, so this is one of the differences between where producer Pete works and where John Barry works. There's different security levels and different specialties of units depending on the type of people that are there. In the same way, in a eating disorder ward, you know, there are some that can be that specific down to a illness. Was there anything else you wanted to kind of add in terms of the episode? Do you feel like we covered what units like this are really like?
You gave a pretty comprehensive view of what the sort of units I work on are. Obviously, mine would be very different to his. Mine is more forensic-based. I get that impression anyway. But no, I think we've covered it really well. It's quite comprehensive, really. Mm.
Yeah, he didn't talk about forensic point of view, did he?
But you know what? On a positive note, it really reassures me to think that if I did ever have someone I know be sectioned, or if it was ever to happen to me, the fact that people like Pete and people like John Barry are the ones looking after the patients, I find incredibly reassuring. You know, the staff do such an incredible job, but you also have to be such an incredible person to stick with that and to give such care under what can be incredibly difficult circumstances.
Yeah, and I like that from John Barry when he was telling us that they try and make it a place that's not scary in his hospital, and that people who are being sectioned not to worry. You know, there's a lot of stigma around people not wanting to present with their illness to their GPs or whatever, because if you're sectioned, you go to a hospital.
Right, and that is difficult, I think, about this, but also about so many mental health professions, that you need to actually be invested in the work and care about people to do it effectively. There's not an option where you get to just turn up and do your hours. You actually have to care about people getting better.
Yeah, you do. Unfortunately, we just don't have that luxury everywhere. But I think the majority of our carers do.
And that's something that a little bit, I think, John Barry alluded to, that you kind of have to be innovative in that sort of role.
Yeah.
That you have to do your best to please as many patients when they're far outnumbering you. And sometimes that takes a certain amount of creative thinking.
Yeah.
So I'll always be an advocate for better support in roles like this, because if they're not supported, they're going to struggle to go above and beyond in the way that so often is necessary to achieve the job. Absolutely. And you can't say that for everything. There's so many jobs where going above and beyond is unnecessary.
Mm.
It doesn't make a difference. Whereas this is people's lives. So I'm so glad to have covered this episode. I'm so glad to work with people like John Barry to remove this kind of specific stigma. Like in our upcoming episode with Dr. Rada, we talk about the deeper stigma, the surface level stuff. The general stigma can be easier to tackle, but when there's specific depths of stigma to experiences like this one, it's a whole different challenge.
Yeah.
So we'll get into that episode with John Barry in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, I'm John Barry and I'm a mental health nurse. So I was very lucky growing up. Both mum and dad were both nurses, mental health nurses, and we grew up on a mental health unit. Not on a unit, that sounds really bad. But basically, back in the day, we used to have massive grounds for hospitals, and in the grounds, they used to have staff housing, mm-hmm. and that's where we kind of lived. And so I was always surrounded by people with mental health issues, patients wandering around, and I was never kind of frightened or scared. I was kind of preconditioned to not be scared or worried about people with mental health issues. So I grew up, went to university, and obviously I went to study geography, which has nothing to do with mental health. I guess I kind of kicked against it a little bit. But when I came out of university after doing geography, I fell into a job as being a support worker in a secure hospital. And I was a typical kind of person there. I was like, I won't do any training. I won't do anything because I'm not going to be here long. 10 years later, I'm still there. And I was very lucky that they gave me the opportunity to go to university and study mental health nursing. I was kind of funded by the hospital, St. Andrews, to go and do my training. So they gave me a scholarship kind of fund, which is vital for me because I couldn't have done it without it, because obviously I've got kids, mortgage, things like that. I couldn't have gone to university, particularly now as the government have taken away all the funding for nursing and they've introduced fees as well, so you have to pay to go and do it. So I was very lucky I didn't have to do that. I went away to university, did 3 years there, qualified in March, and I'm now back working in the secure hospital.
I really like what you've mentioned there about being almost preconditioned not essentially have stigma towards those with mental health.
Yeah,
I think that's really key, because so often we find it's due to misinformation and lack of understanding.
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, the perception is, and it's still out there, is kind of the Hollywood version of mental illness, and particularly mental health hospitals. So, you know, psychiatric units get a really bad rap in the movies. I don't know if you've seen the new Joker film.
I have not, okay. For that reason.
Well, right, but even in that, there's a hospital in that, and it's the classic kind of all the patients wearing white coats, there's patients dribbling in the corner, there's kind of people in straitjackets, you know, the usual kind of Hollywood perception.
Right.
And that's not the reality anymore. You know, we kind of, when people come to the hospital, they're really surprised at how clinical it isn't. So it's not very clinical at all. So it's all very homely. It's not their home, but we try and make it as personalised to them as we can. So there's nobody wears uniform. I don't wear uniform. The patients don't wear uniform. All their rooms, they have their own personalised rooms. They can put posters up and things and keep it kind of their own space. And I think that's the confusion people get. What I tend to say is that I don't blame people for having that perception, you know, because if you haven't seen a hospital, you've never heard of a hospital, of course you're going to fill it in with what you have seen, which is like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or, you know, Silence of the Lambs or things like that. But the stigma is real, and it does really affect us on a day-to-day basis in the hospital. The classic story I always give is we had a Halloween party last year, and we rung around the local area. The patient said, it'd be great if we could have a disco, you know, have a DJ. We've got a gym there. We could set up. They dressed it all out in Halloween stuff, and he said, it'd be great if we had a DJ. We rung 8 DJs in the local area, and 7 turned us down when they found out it was a hospital for people with mental illnesses. They said, no way, not coming in. And then the guy who did turn up, he got to the reception area, and we have kind of like an airlock, because it's a secure unit, you know, so we have to stop people coming in out and be searched. And he saw that, and he said, no way. I didn't realise it was like this, and he bailed as well. So there was no music for the Halloween party, unfortunately. In the end, we had to get like a Bluetooth speaker, so we got by. But it just shows you that the stigma is there, and it does actually have an impact day to day on the patients.
Wow, yeah, and from the flip side, how that would make them feel.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you share that with the patients, why there wasn't?
Well, yeah, I mean, we had to tell them that there's no music, unfortunately, because there's no DJs that have come in, and they're fully aware of it. And actually, one of the reasons they wanted to appear on the podcast that I did is because they want to break that stigma, and they want to show that, you know, we are still people, we are still here. Although they are sectioned, and there's lots of people that are sectioned every year, they don't stop. You know, life doesn't stop just because they're in hospital. And that's what I wanted to show, is that, you know, yes, they have problems, but they still have lots to give and lots to show the world, basically.
Right, it's about normalising that experience, because in so many ways it is like going to any other type of hospital.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, so being sectioned is quite, you know, it can be a traumatic event, and people who have been sectioned, when they've got, I don't know if your readers or listeners will know what sectioning means, but basically means they're put into hospital because they're a risk to themselves or others. So it can be quite a...
Yeah, so it's the removal of certain rights to freedom in their best interest.
Yes, and so that's never going to be nice. You know, it's never going to be an easy thing to do. But, you know, there's loads of fear about hospitals, and people are really, really scared that when they go in, they're going to be there for life and they're locked away and they'll never be seen again. But that's not the case. And that's what I'm trying to show, is that hospitals aren't as bad as people think. And in fact, I had a lovely message on Twitter from a woman who said that she'd listened to the podcast, and she said something like, "I wish I'd had this before I went into hospital."
Wow.
You know, to show that, because I think people's anxiety before they get in is often worse than any image that when they do get in. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
People are so frightened of going in that they're going to be so anxious and perhaps maybe reluctant to get help if they think that when they go to hospital, they're going to be put in a straitjacket and shoved in a corner, you know, and that's not what happens anymore.
I think that's very true. And I think that really affects people in the GP surgeries, that they feel they have to dumb down their emotions. They can't be seen to be irrational in any way or uncontrollably upset, even if that's how they honestly feel.
Yes. And even, you know, the extreme end, people who hear voices, they'll often not say they're hearing voices and won't tell anyone because they're scared that they'll be put into a hospital. And, you know, if anything, hearing voices is a really normal thing. It's very, very common. I think way more common than we had ever thought. And if the voices aren't telling you bad things and they're good, what's the harm in that? You know, that's okay. It's only when they become detrimental to your mental health, that's when maybe we need to step in. But I think there's a big, huge movement at the minute. There's like a hearing voices network and things like that, where they're trying to normalise it and say, no, it's okay to hear voices, that's fine.
Yeah, but again, it's one of those examples that, because it's so outside of normal people's experience, you know, if you've not been to a mental health hospital, you've only got Hollywood to go on.
Yes.
And if you've not heard voices, it's the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And people are scared. And I read some stat, you'll have to find the exact figures, but I'm sure it was something like, from first symptom to actually first contact with services, something like 7 years for people who have voices or hear voices. So people will often leave it because they're scared to, you know, tell anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously then by the time it's got further along, it might be harder then to kind of control it as much as they might like. So the people have got to be a lot more open, I think. And not just the people who hear the voices, but the people who are being told the people hearing voices.
Yeah.
Which is very difficult. And I think we had, like you were saying earlier, that we have got a great movement where people are a lot more open to talk about mental health. So, but I wanted to make, I think there's a distinction between mental health and mental illness.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's complicated because I suppose if you have really poor mental health, it can lead to mental illness. But I think I'm not judging anyone, but we have kind of an Instagram generation who are very happy to, like, say, I'm feeling anxiety or I'm feeling low-level depression. But when it gets to things like hearing voices or people who are actively suicidal, people tend to check out of that one. You know, they're not maybe as willing to talk about things like that.
Right, that the stigma is assigned more so to the illness side rather than the health side.
Yes,
that's definitely something we see. And we have it even within people that reach out to us.
Mm.
Sometimes listeners will get in touch and they'll talk about they had a mental health.
Yes.
Because people are just so used to avoiding certain terms because of the stigma. And you don't have a mental health, you have a mental illness.
Yeah.
But it is difficult, and I understand why people shy away from that stuff.
Definitely,
but we need to normalise.
But I think you're right. That's what I was going to say. I think there's room for both. So there's room for everybody to talk more openly about their mental health, which is really important. But also there's room for people to talk about mental illness and look at people with mental illness and talk about it and be open about it and maybe not be as scared about it. And I say particularly people that are in hospital.
Yeah, for sure. Because it isn't as scary. People are constantly surprised by meeting people with experience outside of theirs and realising, oh, we've still got lots in common. Just because they have this illness doesn't mean they're fundamentally a different human.
And I'm fascinated. Like, I love doing these interviews and going to talking to people about it, because I think when you tell people, like, they're just interested and intrigued. So they make some assumptions and things like that. Not like that. I go, oh, that's fine. So I was being interviewed by a lady, and she said about, I told the story about the Halloween. And she said, oh, I didn't think they'd be allowed to do Halloween. I said, what do you mean? And she assumed the patients wouldn't be allowed to dress up in Halloween outfits because maybe they might, I don't know, go more mad or something. I don't know what she assumed. But I talked to her and said, no, we have Halloween parties and, you know, they're allowed out. And things like, what, they're allowed out? They're allowed to leave the hospital. And if you just explain to people, I think they're willing to listen, you know.
Yeah, well, that it's also identifying that spectrum.
Mm.
That there's a wide variation of people in mental health hospitals.
Mm.
And in fact, the hospitals themselves vary a whole lot in terms of security level.
Absolutely, yeah.
That you don't have to be, at the very worst, be actively suicidal to be there.
No, you're right. But unfortunately, with the squeeze on resources, unfortunately, everything is being pushed. So you basically have to be worse than you would have had to be in the past to get in. Does that, you know, so basically what they're pushing everything down. So to get it seen, I don't know, your listeners probably know that when if you have a mental health problem now, there's huge waiting lists for anything, any kind of therapy or anything like that. Then to get into a hospital bed is like, Jesus, really, really difficult. And then to get to a secure bed, which is where I work, is even harder than that. So everything is kind of being, what's the word, the levels are being pushed up.
Right.
So when they get to my hospital, where I work, they're probably more extreme than they would have been in the past. Does that make the illness is more ingrained?
That, because that's a pressure that's felt across the board. Yeah. Like in the past, I've worked for the West Midlands Police, and it was similar that we were actively being encouraged to find reasons not to attend certain types of jobs.
Yeah, similar to the community nurse teams now, that they're finding ways to not admit people, which is, you know, really sad, because sometimes, unfortunately, people do need to go to hospital. Like the big shift, the big demographic change in the last 10 years is we used to have a thing called informal beds. So in mental health, you used to have informal beds. So patients would go to a hospital, not be sectioned, just go for a kind of short period of time, and then be let out. So you'd go and have like almost like respite, I suppose, right. Have treatment and things like that, and then go out. But with the squeeze, so beds generally are just staying static, so there's no more new beds being built. So what they've done is just reduce the amount of informal beds. So now to get into hospital, you basically have to be sectioned. So, and that means you have to be a danger to yourself or others. Where, you know, I'm not a politician, but it makes no sense to me, because you would save money if you just put it in at the start, because it costs a lot more money to put someone, you know, for someone to be sectioned and be in hospital, in a secure hospital, costs a lot more than if you just put therapy or kind of respite bed in at the start. And that's just money, but, you know, also for the person's mental well-being is, you know, way better if they get seen first rather than leaving it till it escalates.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that informs the stigma as well, that people get scared of seeking support because increasingly the support is the more extreme further down the line support. Yes.
Or they'll just get knocked back. Yeah. That's another, you know, if you've got a mental health issue and you come and talk to someone, you're kind of seeking validation, right? You're seeking, what you've got is really bad and we can give you some help. If you go to a GP and he says, we'll give you some help, but it's a 12-month waiting list, you know, you must think, well, you know, that means it's not too bad. You know, I don't know, people need help and maybe they're not getting it as quickly as they should.
Mm-hmm. And so if we go a little bit back to your own experience.
Sorry, yeah.
And where you first got into mental health nursing, given that you'd grown up in that kind of environment, was it what you expected in the job?
It was, kind of. So I guess in terms of dealing with people with mental illnesses and people who have mental health issues, I didn't really have an issue working with them. But I do work in a secure hospital, and the first day you're in there is quite scary. You know, you have to go in, you have keys, you have to open the door. Once the door's locked, you're like, I'm in here now, and I can't get out, and they can't get out. And so it is quite scary. But you grow to get used to it, and now I can't think of anywhere else I'd work.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think a lot of professions are like that, that they can be so difficult, but because you're helping people, there's no comparison.
No.
Like, my parents both work for the NHS, and they've always worked so, so hard.
Yeah.
I don't think they would elsewhere.
Yeah.
But they care about the cause, they care about helping people.
I think you're right, without being narcissistic or whatever, but you just, I enjoy working with patients and you want to do the best for them. I think the unfortunate thing at the moment, like I said to you, that there's kind of a shortage of everything, like nurses, shortage of staff and things like that. And so you can beat yourself up sometimes that you can't do everything that you want to do for the patients. But I think you have to have a really strong sense of, I tried my best today, you know, with the limited resources that I have. And then when you leave, you can't feel guilty about what you couldn't do or maybe manage at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have a really strong sense of, I did my best, I worked really hard, and then that's it, you know.
Right, and I imagine that's difficult because in healthcare, there's such a culture of going above and beyond that the standard is already set very high for you.
Yeah, so I mean, I regularly stay late or, you know, come in on days off and things like that, but I'm trying to rein that back in a bit, you know, because you have to look after yourself, I guess. We're taught that as well. That's a big thing now with the nursing degrees. You have to have self-compassion, you know, because if you don't look after yourself, you will burn out and you won't be able to look after the patients. But it's hard, you know, if a patient has to have home leave or you want to do something for them, you know, sometimes you do go above and beyond.
Do you feel like, to an extent, you have to be an example to the patients in that way?
Maybe a little bit, I guess. I mean, it's hard. So on my ward, there's 16 patients. So it's really difficult to fit everyone in at the same time, you know, and there might be one that's been wanting to speak to you the whole day and you had other stuff to do and they just say, look, can I just have 5 minutes? You go, okay, I'll give them 5 minutes. It turns into half an hour, you know. But when you leave, and they're really grateful and they're really thankful, and that's the big thing I would say, the patients know when you've tried. So if you tried and you can't do it or something's gone wrong, they will appreciate that you've given it a go. I think when you just go like, oh, that can't happen today, sorry, we ain't got enough staff, you know, that's when they'll kind of get a bit upset. But if you say, look, I'm going to try my best, I'll ring around the other wards, I'll try and organise things, they kind of recognise when you put the extra effort in.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's something really important to remember, that when people are sectioned, that's their whole world.
Yes.
Against their choice.
Yeah.
That everything that happens on that ward is their life.
Yeah, and we never, you can never lose sight of, and I try never to lose sight of the fact that I do get to go home, you know, and do have keys. And, you know, whatever you think about it, there is a power differential there. Like, I have the keys, I can go home. These guys can't. They are kind of sectioned.
Right, exactly. So your bad day at work is their bad day of life.
Yes, yeah. And so it is difficult. Like, I'm not, you know, the podcast I've done is trying to show the good side and that it's maybe not as bad as people think. So hospitals aren't as, you know, what the image they have in their head. But at the end of the day, these patients are really unwell. And so there are tough times, you know, on the ward. And then the kind of tough times you have to deal with and manage and learn to cope with, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was there a time when you started that sticks out in your head as the first time your work really challenged you or a particular patient?
Yeah, lots of times, lots of. I mean, so we have some patients that are really unwell and sometimes self-harm quite a lot, so quite prolifically. And seeing that for the first time was really quite scary. You know, seeing someone do that to themselves, you think, God, what's happened? And it never becomes normalised. You do become a little bit desensitised to it. So now I see it and I just go into function work, okay, so we need to dress the wound, we need to sort things out. And it's only afterwards you think, oh, God, that was quite bad. You know, and it's really interesting for me when I see new people start and they see them kind of things, and that, it's like what I was like when I first started. Like, and they're correct. So the reaction should be like, oh, my God, what's happened? And you should feel kind of a bit horrified by what this person has done. But because you've seen it so much, you kind of just get on with it for that moment. But then it does come back and you do have to process it and think, like, Christ, that was really him.
And I would imagine it's a difficult balance as well, that although that's a natural response to react in that way, you also don't want to stress the patient out more.
Yeah, that is one of the hardest things. So obviously the patients can sometimes get very stressed and get very elevated and you have to do the opposite. So you have to come down, and because then you're just starting to have an argument. You know, sometimes the patient, shouting and screaming, you have to be very calm and say, okay, what do you want us to do? Because if you start raising your voice and start raising your anxiety levels, then you're just going to end up in an argument.
Yeah, because when someone's that agitated, they can't really tell your intention. So if you're shouting you're just a threat, even if you're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, that can happen. Like I said, that the patients sometimes get very upset and you have to kind of not be upset. But even that, so even seeing someone upset and crying, that's really hard too, you know, to witness. And again, like I say, you have to kind of process it yourself, and maybe not at the time, but you do deal with it afterwards.
And so what kind of support is there for you after you've been in these situations?
Alcohol. No, I'm just kidding. So every month, I think, we're supposed to have supervision. So we have it's called clinical supervision, but it's almost like counselling. So basically, we just get to talk to someone and you kind of talk through the incidents and events that have happened that month. We also have a trauma counsellor. So if there's severe incidents that have happened on the ward, she'll come and talk to you again. For me, we mentioned about the Irish background, talking. I just love talking to... I need to talk to someone just to get out and make sure it's not stuck in my head for ages. And I do tend to kind of procrastinate and, you know, keep going over and over things. But I think that's healthy sometimes in our profession, to just keep reflecting back on what you could earn differently or what, you know, or sometimes just to talk is good.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely, because a lot of these situations are unfortunately common.
So, the nature of the ward is... Every day there'll probably be some kind of, that's a lie. Not every day, but some days there'll be lots of incidents and you have to just kind of, you can't stop to think about that one because there's another one going on. So you've got to deal with that one too.
Yeah. And you reminded me of something that I found quite fascinating with this is that you can have a kind of mood on the ward.
Is oh, absolutely. A lot? Yeah, oh my God, yeah, you're very right. But it works both ways. So you have, sometimes you'll have a mood where you come on and you think, oh, there's a lot of tension here. You know, you can just kind of feel it in the air. You can feel some of the patients are getting a bit loud and maybe they're getting a bit upset and so something happens and then knock-on effect, it something else happens, and then before you know, everybody's kind of upset. But it works in reverse as well. So when there's like a settled period or good period on the ward, it tends to, what's the word, keep going. So the patients don't want, sorry, I keep tapping, sorry. Patients don't want to, I don't say ruin it, but the kind of, they all have their, if they're all doing well, they want each other to do well.
Right.
Does that make sense? So if one starts going a bit downhill, they'll kind of support them. But like I said, it's really hard when they're two or three or four of them are all unwell, then it's difficult for them to pick each other up. So yeah, you're right. There's definitely a mood on the ward. You can sometimes feel it. But like I said, both ways, good and bad, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, that's good, I guess, in a way, because it makes a lot of sense when people are in that close proximity.
Yeah.
I guess the closest comparison I can think of is maybe if you're in a school and then there's a, you know, the exams are coming up and everyone's stressed. It's like this contagious attitude when people are living in such close proximity.
Yeah, well, interestingly, because I only qualified in March, but one of my placements was a CAMS placement.
Right.
And they have a crisis team in CAMS. And I said to them, like, when's your busiest time? And they said exam time. So exam time is when they get their most referrals, their most calls, most kids stressed out. And that made me really sad because I thought, that's just an invented thing that we've put on, you know, exams and GCSEs or whatever. You don't have to have them. You know, it's just something that society has decided that we have to have exams. I mean, I did 2 years at university as a nurse. I didn't do any exams. It was all kind of project work and all kind of essays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so are exams really as important as our children's mental health? I don't think so.
Well, I would agree. It's tricky because we have to balance it. People still need to be educated. But that's something we had a lot of comments about when doing our campaign for mental health education,
right,
which is still ongoing, that petition. And with that, a lot of people didn't read it. They kind of read the headline and then made assumptions that we were going to put in like a lesson on mental health where you'd have exams and you'd have a textbook.
Oh, right, like you're going to do a course on, oh, I see. Right,
as opposed to what we were actually pushing for, which was more of a PSHE style, like sex ed and how that's taught. But there were so many people coming with concerns about that because they know how bad exams can be for our mental health. So the understanding is there.
So I see that. So the irony was they thought you were going to have an exam about mental health and stress during exams or whatever. But no,
which to be very clear was never the plan.
No, I mean, the mental health stuff in schools is just, it just makes sense, right? Because I've attended loads of conferences and things like that. And they say it works in all ways. So it helps the kids. To de-stress them, but also they get better results anyway. If you give them mental health training, you know, they will do better in school anyways, and they'll be better people and better humans. Yeah, I'm all for it. I'll sign it. I don't know where the signature is, but I'll do it.
Yeah, so I'll put a link in the description for the episode as well.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, feeds on to later in life that, you know, perhaps people, when they get more and more unwell, that, you know, they might end up in hospital, and hopefully I can show maybe the hospital isn't as bad as they might have thought. I'm not saying that everyone who does an exam is going to end up in hospital. I'm just saying, you know, that youth is where it starts, I guess.
Absolutely. And one of the things you mentioned off air was the background of a lot of the patients you deal with. Yeah. Do you mind sharing a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I think I said to you that the number one thing you can do if you want to reduce people being in hospital is just stop abusing kids. I mean, I know that sounds really twee and thing, but unfortunately, a lot of the patients we have do have backgrounds of, you know, abuse and neglect and things like that. And so if you wanted to reduce people going into hospital and having mental health issues, just have better services for kids and really just stop abusing kids. I know that sounds, I'm not being flippant when I say that. I'm just saying that there's lots of, you know, child abuse still going on out there. And later in life, that's going to affect people in a really detrimental way. So, yeah, that's just that. That would help. It would transform mental health services if we just had less kids being abused.
Right. And that's true. And also, I think that's very much a sign of the type of support you're giving. So the people that are in these very extreme dark places, that often comes from certain types of trauma.
Yeah.
And while some of it is part of life, like if you lose a parent young, that can affect your whole life. Sadly, that's not avoidable in a lot of cases, but abuse should be avoidable.
Absolutely, yeah. And like you said, that's, I mean, just to be clear, that not all the patients in with me would have been abused, and that's not what I'm saying, but, you know, a high proportion would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they might have had traumatic events. Sometimes they've had upbringings and things like that, which are really kind of, you know, they're horrendous, really. You know, looking at their histories and things like that, and you think, it's no wonder they've ended up with mental health problems. So maybe if we could change it at the start, then we wouldn't have to, you know, have these patients in hospital.
Yeah, because that's one thing that I don't think is always understood for these kind of environments, how broad the support is, that it's not just a case of you're keeping people secure or you're giving them medication.
Mm.
There is so much support in terms of like classes they do and the one-on-one time they get to have with the nurses and all this time and space to be looked after.
Well, that is, I mean, one of the patients said in one of the podcasts, I said to him, what's been the thing that's, you know, helped? And he just pointed at his watch, he said time. He said the time to heal my brain, basically. He said just have time to get away and kind of process everything. And that's what he needed. And another big thing that comes across in all of them is that they all mention, so I'm a nurse, so obviously I think it's medication and therapy is the thing that helps, which I think does help. But they all say, no, it's the connections they make. So the people they talk to and the friends they make and talking to people daily is the thing that's got them better.
Right.
And I think I mentioned to you that outside, unfortunately, with the cuts that are going on, they're the things that are the first thing to be cut, is the kind of the free stuff. So the free stuff you have in the community for people that maybe don't have money, like libraries, day centres, cafe mornings, things like that. They're the things that go, but they're the things that are vital for particularly patients that have got mental health issues, because they can go there and just talk to someone. And it doesn't have to be like an in-depth, really therapeutic conversation. It can just be, oh, the weather's really rubbish today. Oh, yeah. Or how did your football team do last night? Or whatever it is, just that human kind of interaction is what people need.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so important. And also, you're creating a safe space by doing that. The sectioning goes both ways. On one hand, they're secure and kept safe. But on the other hand, they're also kept safe from potentially what's happening in the outside world for them. That it's a chance to step away from all of that, be in a space where all you have to focus on is recovery.
Yeah, and one of the good things, I guess, about being sectioned is legally we have to give aftercare. So we, once they're, you know, deemed to not be at risk and we discharge them from section, they still have to have someone to follow them up and keep an eye on them. Like, legally, we have to do that. So that's good as well. So even if they do leave the hospital, they've still got that kind of support of someone or somebody that can still check in on them and make sure they're still doing all right.
That's really great. It's reminding me, actually, even in the way people describe the privilege of counselling, that you have this time that's just for you to talk about whatever you want. And I think in many ways it's quite similar, that you've got this time while you're there, and you just have to focus on getting better.
Yeah, and I mean, we're making it sound, you know, all rosy, and you know, and it is, you know, it's great for them to have the time, but sometimes, particularly initially when they come in, they don't want to be there,
right.
and they're very resistive to any kind of, you know, help or support, because they'll think, well, I don't need it. And sometimes that can be challenging, you know, you have to, it takes time for them to kind of recognise themselves that maybe they do need support and do need help. And everything becomes easier when the patients kind of buy into it. So once the patients, you know, kind of take the support, and sometimes that takes a while, everything becomes easier, yeah.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess it's like that with any type of support we have. You've got to commit to it. You could go into a counselling room and not speak to the counsellor. Nothing is going to be achieved.
Yeah. And that's not for me to say, like, oh, you should, you know, take the support. Is that, you know, something that's really difficult. If you're in the midst of, like, a mental health crisis, you're not going to be able to talk to someone, you know, for a consistent amount of time. And we need to think of better ways to kind of talk to you. So, like I said, we have to think of, sometimes you think outside the box of what does the patient want to do. So that's what we're trying to do, is focus on what they like doing. So there's one guy who loves football, so he goes and plays football every day, you know, in the gym and things like that. And he then starts talking to the gym instructor about really, you know, kind of profound things that he wouldn't do to a counsellor. So if you sat down to him and said, right, okay, so we're going to have this counselling session for an hour, he wouldn't talk, he'd kind of freeze up. But if he's playing football, it's kind of a bit more relaxed, and he's doing something he enjoys, you can kind of engage him a bit. Other patients love music, so we have like a recording studio, they love going to a recording studio, doing the music and bits like that. And again, they'll talk to the music therapist or the music TI about their life and all kinds of things that they wouldn't talk to maybe me or a counsellor about. And so sometimes you do have to think of things that will engage them. And that's part of the kind of the art, I guess, of nursing, is trying to find the thing
absolutely
they want.
And that's what can too often be ignored, because it's not the strictly scientific side. instead it's the more human approach of how can we support this individual.
I mean, I absolutely agree with you that it's more of an art than a science, because you could have two patients with exactly the same symptoms, exactly the same diagnosis. You try the same things and it won't work for it'll work for one and not for the other. So you have to find something that person enjoys and likes doing and work on them as an individual rather than... I mean, I tend to like even... patients that I interviewed and things like that, I tend to not focus on the diagnosis because I'm more interested in the person on the day. Does that make sense?
Right,
So if a patient is hearing voices and might have schizophrenia, but today they're depressed because it's an anniversary of a death, I'm dealing with the depression side of it rather than the schizophrenia side of it. And then, you know, way around, sometimes you might have patients that may have drug-induced psychosis, but that's not their formal diagnosis, so you're going to have to deal with the voices that they're hearing at the moment, but for a long period you're going to have to deal with maybe the depression that they've got or whatever. So I tend not to focus on the... I mean, it's instructive, I guess, to because you can, you know, what's worked in the past for someone with this diagnosis, you know, does help, but also you need to focus on the individual.
Right, because even with people that just have a single diagnosis, the symptoms can vary so much.
Oh, yeah.
How they are day-to-day can vary so much.
Mm.
And I think that's so important. And we find that all the time here on the podcast, that it can be surprising the things that brought people through the worst of their illness.
Yeah.
It can be the medication. It can be quite formalized support. But it can equally be getting into music or journaling or any number of other things.
Yeah, and I think that same for our patients. Something will click one day and they go, actually, no, I don't want to be in hospital anymore. I want to get better and I want to get well. And that is different for all of them. So one guy, he really hated the hospital food. I mean, this was a while ago. The hospital food's changed now. It's very nice. But back then it wasn't maybe as nice. And he said, I hate this food. I want to get out. And that was it. And from that day, he decided to do everything, channel everything, you know, took time and he got out. Similar with, unfortunately, with the smoking. So we don't have smoking in the hospital anymore. And that sometimes is just the spark enough to get people out. So people go, well, I want to get leave because I want to go and have a fag. And that's enough to, you know, to get them engaged in kind of therapy. I know that's wrong. But it's different for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's really key. It's like one of those difficult grey areas because we're not encouraging smoking. But at the same time, it can sometimes be just one thing that motivates people to make those next steps.
Yeah, and I'm not endorsing smoking either, but like you said, if it works for the patient, then
but great. Also for some patients, that'll be a part of their freedom of not being sectioned that they miss.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
That's a motivator.
And who am I to say that, you know, they shouldn't, you know, they're just like anybody else. If they want to smoke when they're outside, that's up to them.
Yeah.
So we often get people ask about delusions, and do we challenge the delusions that people have, and do we like force them to go, no, that's definitely not real? And me personally, I don't challenge people, but I don't necessarily agree with them either.
Mm.
So I kind of, if someone's got a really fixed delusion, I don't say, no, that's absolutely false, that's incorrect, you don't have wings, or whatever it might be, because that person's then not going to come and talk to me the next time they're not feeling well. But what I don't do is go, yes, I can see them, yes, they're beautiful. You know, I try and go in the middle, say, okay, well, tell me what, you know, what they look like and what they like, rather than dismiss it, but also don't confirm it. Kind of
right, yeah, that's really
middle.
Tricky because it can be so jarring for that person and really stressful if you're just out and out arguing with them about what is, for them at that time, their reality.
Yeah, because what benefit is it going to be for the patient or me? If I challenge them and go, no, you're wrong, that's not correct, you know, it's not good for me and it's not good for them, because that's what they believe at the time. So maybe like when they're in a slightly better place, you can look back at it. And actually, I was going to say that one of the things that all the patients talk about is they know they're getting better when they have the ability to laugh at themselves.
Mm.
So when they can look back at some of the things that they've thought or done and they've gone, oh, God, I was a bit mad then, wasn't I? You know, and just like us, you know, sometimes we do silly things and stupid things and we can look back and go, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that. Same with the patients. They sometimes have delusions and beliefs and they go, oh, God, I can't believe I was thinking that. But they want to have the ability to laugh at themselves.
Right, because it's a sign of their self-awareness rising again.
Absolutely, yeah. And maybe then the next time they have them, they can think, oh, actually, that wasn't correct the last time, so maybe it's not correct this time.
Yeah, that's a great way of explaining it, because that's so key to delusions, where you're like seeing, maybe hearing things, these kind of experiences, because it's a symptom of an illness.
Yeah.
It's not something that's really happening. It's not something they're doing on purpose. It's because of their illness. So if you can focus instead on treating the illness rather than arguing with their version of reality, a lot of that will fade away anyway.
Yeah, and like you said, to what end? Like, they believe that at that time. I've had it before, you know, people have tried to challenge patients and they'll show them, look, no, you haven't got this. And they'll say, well, that's fake. You know, they'll show them a video recorder, or whatever it might be. They'll have particular evidence and they'll go, no, that's obviously false. That's fake evidence and things like that. So whatever you challenge, you're not going to win anyway. So,
And if that person's ill enough, they're not going to believe it anyway.
They won't, because that's their reality. So like I said, my advice to anyone who's having delusions or talking to anyone who has delusions is not confirm, but don't deny. And I know that's a bit weird. That's like in between, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really key, though, and you've explained it well. It's something similar I was taught when I worked for Samaritans as well, that you're there to listen to people, and you might be the only person in their life that isn't going to do that, isn't going to disagree and argue about it.
Mm.
And that can be incredibly reassuring.
I agree.
So we'll start wrapping up now, but the last thing I wanted to finish on a positive note with is, what kind of things on the ward bring you joy?
Well, there's lots of things. And I think that's one of the hardest part of the job, is the job gets very difficult. But I always try and pick out one good thing that's happened in the day and focus on that rather than focus on maybe something negative. So I had a patient yesterday or the other day say to me, are you working tomorrow? And I said, no. And she said, oh. So she was sad that I wasn't working the next day. So that made me feel good. I got a Christmas card yesterday that said, to the best nurse in the world.
Oh,
that was pretty nice. So things like that. And that, they're the really small things, and they're the things that will get you through. But, you know, we have big things as well. We've got patients. So we had a patient that's been on home leave, so hadn't been home for like 5 years. And so has managed to go home and visit the family. And to be part of that is really kind of amazing, really. To see someone who's really, really unwell and get through it and kind of get to a stage where they're able now to go and have leave is... it's unbelievable, really.
Yeah, I love that. And that's really where it comes together, what's best for the patients and what's best for yourself.
Yeah, and I think you wouldn't get that if you didn't see them in, like, not at their worst, but, you know, some of the patients are really, really unwell.
Mm.
And you see kind of them when they're at their, I suppose, yeah, they are at their worst. And to see them get to a stage where they can go out is, I mean, that's what the job's all about, right?
Yeah, and you can't help but be invested in that when you're working in such close proximity to them. You're such a massive part of their life and vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Rightly or wrongly, we are a community, I guess, and we all kind of support each other. But yeah, they're fantastic. And I do enjoy the job, even though it is incredibly difficult sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't enjoy the good times as much if you didn't have the hard times.
I think that's really key. I mean, we started off by talking a bit about Hollywood. It's not a coincidence that they like to put a dark story into even the bubbliest of Disney films.
Yeah, yeah. And interestingly, whenever you hear about hospitals in Hollywood, it's always the baddie comes from, like a mental hospital, you know. What's his name? The Halloween guy. It's always, they're always escaped from a psychiatric hospital or something like that. It's always a negative spin on a mental hospital.
Right, whereas actually, the more you learn about this area, the more you realise that the skills you learn by experiencing mental illness, like empathy, like resilience, make a brilliant hero.
Oh, unbelievable. Like the patients, I've seen more, you know, love, compassion, heart, determination from people with mental illnesses than anyone else, because, you know, they've been to the low points, and so to come back is unbelievable. And for them to, you know, share their story and try and help other people is inspiring.
That's very true. And I imagine you do such a wonderful job.
I don't know about that. I don't take compliments very well. But yeah, I think nurses generally do a great job, yeah.
That's good enough. And so if anyone is hearing this and is potentially going to be getting this kind of support in the future, what would you say to them about it?
Well, I would say maybe find out about the place you go in, or find out about hospitals that in general, and maybe recognise that they're not the images that they think they have in their head, and go and visit them. You can go and see them. So basically, challenge your perceptions, listen to the podcast, the podcast I've got. But yeah, the idea, I suppose, would be to reach out and see these places for yourself rather than have the image in your head of what they might be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's incredibly normalising.
Yes. So try and, that's what I'm trying to do, try and normalise the hospital experience, the psychiatric hospital experience for people that may be having to go in.
Great. I love that. And so if people want to learn more about you and hear your show, where should they go?
Yeah, so the podcast is called On The Ward. You can find it on the internet, anywhere you get your podcast, so Apple or Google, or else you can visit the St Andrews Healthcare website and there'll be like a link there you can find. We're also on Twitter, # On The Ward, but you'll find us.
Great. I will put a link to it on Apple Podcasts.
That'd be great. Thanks. And best of luck with your live show.
Thank you. Yes.
Very well.
It's very exciting.
And I do think what you guys are doing is really important. So you are kind of challenging stigma. And even if it's at the lower end, it's great because it helps everybody if everybody talks a bit more about mental health.
Thank you so much. And it's always great to meet people doing the same work, you know, share in this joint vision. And that's been one of the most incredible things of having a podcast like this, the community around mental health.
Yeah.
I just had no idea how big and how vibrant it is.
I mean, everybody's got it, right? So everybody needs to look after their mental health. So
absolutely. So thank you again.
And thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.